That's so creepy. What are you doing?
All right. Hi, guys. Welcome to episode 2 of the Pint Size Podcast. We're back. It's been a little bit of a trek getting here with the whole coronavirus thing that's happening right now, but we are here. This is episode 2, and I'm going to start over again.
Okay.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to episode 2 of the Pint-Sized Podcast. We're here, myself, Julian Elstub, Gilly Moon.
Hi.
We are ready to hit this next episode. It's going to be crazy. It's going to be fun. And
it's going to be educational.
It is going to be educational. Gilly, what new updates do we have for our fans?
We got some new gear. Episode 1 was recorded on like a Yeti snowball mic that we scrounged up because we have a lot of random shit in our house. So we splurged and got 2 MXL 990 mics with really nice shock mounts. And we have a Scarlett, I think the model number is I-8-I-something. It's a 4 input channel interface, so hopefully we can record guests on the show soon.
Yeah, as so well. We sound legit as so, fuck.
God,
now.
I hope so. And we're recording for nerds that want to hear the rest of everything. We are recording straight into Logic, which we also did last time. And I'm keeping track of loudness standards with a free plugin called a Yulean, spelled Y-O-U. L-E-A-N, loudness meter?
Yeah, not Julian, which would
be But it rhymes with your name.
It would be better.
Okay. Sure it would. so we can make sure we stay in the ballpark of, you know, standards, whatever those are.
Anyway.
Yeah, so that's our gear update. I did want to update everyone on something that was mentioned last episode. We were talking about, like, beverage rankings and mentioned that beer was the most popular beverage after water and tea. And I said, but wait, what about coffee? So I looked it up, and I have the actual rankings. Beverage number 1 is tea. 2 is coffee. Beer is the 3rd. So basically everything I drink is in the top 3. The 4th favorite beverage is soup.
Which is bullshit, because that's not a drink. Let's just put that there.
I think it depends on what, like, if no, it's clam chowder.
No, I'm sorry. Soup? No, clam. You don't drink clam chowder like, oh, yeah, I'm going to Jamba Juice to get a clam chowder. You're not doing that. That's bullshit. 4, struck from the record.
Valid. Beverage number 5 is energy drinks.
Yeah, apparently we've got a lot of Kyles in this country. That's all I'm saying.
Beverage number 6 is vodka. Number 7 is wine. Number 8 is Coca-Cola. Number 9 is milk. I don't know if that includes, like, dairy and the almond or the oat.
Yeah, this whole list makes me feel really bad for America.
But number 10 is orange juice, which just means we gotta all get our vitamin C up.
I guess so.
So do you want to kind of, like, intro us on what we're covering in this episode?
Yes.
I think this is really fun. I'm really excited.
So Gilly, we did completely skip over one of our kind of core which is, what are we drinking?
Oh, yeah. Are we opening these up as we...
I think so. I need to find something to open mine with. You just opened yours. I have a crescent wrench right here, so I'm going to open it with a crescent wrench. Oh, God. Here we go. There it is.
This might overfoam. Please don't do this.
Gilly has the most gigantic can over there.
So... also has a fitting name for the gigantic can. I am drinking a chocolate cherry Yeti Imperial Stout. I kind of have a soft spot for kind of pastry-inspired porters. I'm not sure why. I do really enjoy pastries,
Who
too.
Made that?
Great Divide. I haven't ever tried this before, so I'm going to let the foam come down a little bit, and then I'll let y'all know how it is by the end of the episode.
And I'm actually pretty boring because coronavirus has made us... a little bit of homebodies. So I'm actually just doing the Sierra Nevada 40th anniversary hoppy anniversary ale. you know, so forward. I like it. So forward. I saw the thing that said hop forward and I just kind of kept going. But yeah, it's just a, you know, so far a nice hoppy West Coast IPA.
I actually really love Sierra Nevada. I remember drinking a Sierra Nevada beer after like one of the first races I ever ran, and it was literally the best thing I could have had in that moment besides water.
I've done one race in my career. As a racer, as a runner, really, because definitely I am a total runner. I'm not. And I remember doing this 5K and getting to the end, and Gilly was actually doing, what were you doing, a 10K?
It was a 15K? Something like that. It was a 9.3 challenge. Yeah. So it was like 3 miles.
So,
and then,
like, I got to the end and I got my beer, and it was just like, it is the best thing. Like, after you're running, you're just like, oh my God, I got a beer.
Why do
it's
you think I
best.
Actually run?
But yeah, so we're here, episode 2. And we kind of felt like episode 2 was going to be really important for our listeners to. We were talking about this for so long and trying to figure out, like, oh my God, how do we structure these episodes? How do we make a lesson plan for our listeners? As you can tell, like, I come from the child of two teachers. Like, how do we make this lesson plan? One of the biggest things that we thought that was going to be important for, for this podcast is kind of teaching you guys, like, what we know about beer and maybe... Hopefully, like, I mean, some of you guys might know this, some of you guys might not, but, you know, where did beer come from? Like, this is going to be a huge part of almost every episode we touch on. Where did it come from? Where are the kind of influences and things like that? So we figured the best way to do that, to kind of really kick this off, was the history of beer, throwing it, you know, thousands of years into the past and figuring out how do we make that, you know, into a listenable thing.
And I think y'all are kind of gonna, what I hope everyone gathers from this episode is that throughout lots of history, beer has shaped a lot of things like economics and society and even how people fall within their social classes, which is really cool. Yeah, it's had a lot of weight since almost the beginning of time.
Yeah, I mean, literally, it's been around and part of human culture since the beginning of recorded history. Like, literally, the history of human the history of human civilization is the history of beer. We've been researching this one for a really long time. I'm kind of hoping that, like, some of our research, you know, going forward is a little bit less heavy than this, because obviously Gilly and I are not historians. And so a lot of the stuff we're doing is, like, you know, tertiary kind of, we're getting stuff from not primary sources doing this. But it's so important to the story that we're going to tell through this podcast that we figured we can't not do it. But literally, beer is the story of human civilization. Anthropologists believe that man moved away from a hunter-gatherer experience to a settled agriculture based largely to grow enough grain to brew beer and bread and to, you know, grow vegetables and to literally not have to be constantly running from things. One of the things that anthropologists have found from, you know, their smart people studies, because I'm not a smart person, is that anything from insects to elephants, fruit bats to monkeys, they all love this thing that we call ethanol. Ethanol, it's in beer, it's in anything that you drink from a bar that's gonna get you drunk. Ethanol is alcohol.
So every species likes to get wasted.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, like, it's crazy. Like, you know, Gilly and I have been doing so much research on this, and everything we find is, like, all these anthropologists are like, yep, every species on Earth kind of likes booze. So it's pretty reasonable to believe that, you know, we and other animals evolved according to these advantages that alcohol can offer. And Gilly's going to kind of take us through this weird, like, what scientists think and how they think that we can get there.
So fruit, when it's ripe, gives off an alluring scent that tells animals that it is full of sugar and ready to eat. Ripe fruit can become quite alcoholic when naturally present yeasts begin to consume the sugars. So animals get the benefit of the food value of the fruit, but also find a value in the physiological effects of consuming alcohol. The fruiting plants, in turn, derived the benefit of the animal's actions as a disperser of its seeds.
It's the circle of life. So, when you think about that, like, ancient humanity, like, you know, the biggest thing for them was discovering fermentation. Like, fermentation, it's how you make bread. It's how you make beer. It's how you make any sort of alcohol. It's how you make soy sauce. It's everything. So, again, like, because of the fact that this is a history episode, a lot of what we're going to cover today isn't, like, you're not going to go pick that up at Circus Liquor. Like, it's not, it's not beer. Like, it's going to be something weird. It's probably going to be a little closer to mead. It's probably going to be, not palatable.
Well, the beer we drink today was really invented in Germany during the Middle Ages, and we're covering ancient history.
That is true. So, with that as, you know, as where we're going with this, I want to give you kind of a quick timeline of, you know, how far back we're going. And it goes back like 9,000 years. Like, this is a long time. So 7,000 BC, the first documented evidence of beer making occurred in China. Ancient Chinese brewers concocted a beverage called kui, a beer which was made from rice, fruit, and honey. Bear in mind, not really a beer. Just kind of something sweet and fermented and delicious. So 3510, both beer and wine were brewed in Göden Tepe, which is now an archaeological site in central Iran. I probably mispronounced that, so any Iranian listeners, please let me know. 2250 BC, beer was brewed in ancient Egypt, where it became a vital industry. Beer in Egypt was made from baked barley bread. 2150 to 2000 BC, the Epic of Gilgamesh, a Sumerian epic poem written in ancient Mesopotamia, now Iran, mentioned beer. 1800 BC, a Sumerian poem for the goddess of beer Ninkasi was written. 1754 BC, the Code of Hammurabi also wrote laws regarding the regulation of beer brewing. 1600 BC, ancient Egyptian medical texts wrote over 100 prescriptions for remedies, which included beer. 800 BC, ancient Germans brewed beer using the same method that the ancient Sumerian beer makers employed. And then, 55 BC, Roman legions include beer to northern and central Europe, particularly to the Celtic and Teutonic tribes. That was a lot. We're going to cover all of that in this episode. It's kind of hard to attribute beer to, like, one culture. It's not like, oh my god, this guy in ancient Mesopotamia just invented beer. Like, you can't do it. So, really, what a lot of anthropologists have found is that the discovery of fermentation made a lot of different cultures all kind of discover beer more or less around the same time. Most of the world's fermented beverages emerged alongside the development of cereal agriculture some 12,000 years ago. So, essentially, everybody that is stuck at home right now trying to figure out how to make a sourdough starter, I'm included in them because I am trying. You know, the first recorded version of this is like 3,000 years from where you are right now. So, like, if you can't figure out the sourdough starter, it's okay. You got 3,000 years before, like, archaeologists 12,000 years from now are going to figure it out. So you're good.
Sounds like someone's been doing a lot of pep talks about his bread practices.
Yeah, well, it's true.
So as hunter-gatherer tribes settled into agrarian civilizations based around staple crops like wheat, rice, barley, and maize, you know, corn, they may have also stumbled upon the fermentation process and started brewing beer.
So some of these anthropologists have argued that these early people's insatiable thirst for hooch, may have contributed to the Neolithic Revolution, which is apparently a thing, like, which... What do you think the Neolithic Revolution is? We didn't actually research this.
No, but let's make a note for next time, and maybe we'll intro the next episode with it. My guess is it sounds like when really early people started discovering using, like, actual tools in agriculture.
That's my guess, too, yeah. But, yeah, so essentially, anthropologists think that early people's insatiable thirst for hooch may have contributed to this Neolithic Revolution to inspire new agricultural technology.
So I know you all have been a little cooped up. What we're going to do is we're going to take you around the ancient world. You're welcome. And we're going to talk to you about beer culture. So the earliest known alcoholic beverage is a 9,000-year-old Chinese concoction made from rice, honey, and fruit.
That noise was me taking you on a plane to 9,000 year ago China, by the way.
So, beer is brewed as far back as 7,000 BCE. It's similar to the recipe to how the people in Egypt and Mesopotamia were brewing. It's a rice, honey, grapes, and hawthorn fruit concoction. Ancient Chinese beer was important in ancestral worship, funeral, and other rituals of the Sha, Shang, and Shou dynasties. The beer itself was called Lao Li. After the Han dynasty, Chinese beer faded from prominence in favor of huanzhu. Huanzhu, meaning yellow wine, is a uniquely Chinese alcoholic beverage. Brewed by mixing boiled grains, including rice, nuomi, or millet, with shu as a starter culture, followed by saturification and fermentation for about 2 weeks. Shu is a type of fermentation starter used widely in China for all sorts of things. It's used in vinegar, soy sauce, and preserved tofu.
Yeah, so pretty much it's, you know, the ancient Chinese version of sourdough starter. That's sure. What I'm sounding like. It's like. Cool. So interestingly enough, beer didn't have a comeback in China until about the 19th century when some Polish people immigrated there. They established a brewery in Harbin. And actually, soon after that brewery was established, Chinese people liked beer so much that a bunch of German, Czech, and Polish people came back, set up 3 more breweries there, just in order to keep up with demand.
Yeah, take that, yellow wine. Right? Beer in China is a 5,000-year-old recipe that we more or less know the ins and outs of today, thanks to a study done at Stanford University. So, back in 2016, archaeologists uncovered underground beer-making toolkits that dated back to 3400 to 2900 BCE. These beer-making kits were discovered at a dig site in the central plain of China. The kits included funnels, pots, and specialized jugs. The shapes of the objects suggest that they could be used for brewing, filtration, and storage. The research group that inspected the pots found grains inside.
Oh my god, grains!
Oh my god, grains! So that's how we know that they were used for beer. The recipe that the ancient people of China brewed included a mix of fermented grains, broomcorn millet, and Job's Cheers, which is a chewy Asian grain, also known as Chinese pearl barley. The recipe also used yam or lily roots, depending on what the brewer felt like. The recipe also called for tubers, the starchy and sugary parts of plants, which were added to sweeten and flavor the beer. So the lead researcher on this archaeological dig, named Jia Jingwen from Stanford University, guessed that this beer would taste a bit sour, but also a bit sweet.
It would go very well with sweet and sour pork.
Since this beverage wasn't filtered, it looked like more of a porridge, and one would drink it with a straw.
Gets you more drunk.
Probably. So finding barley grains in ancient beer-making kits gives us cause to think that barley, which was domesticated in Western Asia at the same time, made its way over to China. The researchers on the team hypothesized that beer formed hierarchical classes in ancient China. Barley was probably brought to China just to make beer, so it was an exotic ingredient all the upper classes and royalties could show off. The researchers took this 5,000-year-old recipe, back to Stanford and asked their students to sort of recreate this concoction. The students were allowed to use wheat, millet, or barley seeds. White mold would form on top of the concoction, but when students tasted a beer brewed with red wheat, it tasted citrusy and smelled fruity, which was reminiscent of
Gross.
Cider.
But that apparently all sounds delicious. Kind of gnarly.
But apparently delicious.
I mean, good. I want to try 5,000-year-old beer. That sounds great.
Really fermented.
Like, what if you, like, you know, you're just, like, going in your back closet and you find something and you knock off a little bit of that white mold and you're like, oh, die, that looks good, you know? So we're going to
go across a couple of C's.
That's what I just did, yeah. So now we're going to talk about ancient Egypt, Mesopotamia, that whole kind of Fertile Crescent area. I am really excited to do this because this is like a subject that, like, just familial wise, like, my mom is she's a sixth grade teacher and she absolutely adores her Egypt Mesopotamia sections on this, and it's something that's been hammered into me from an early age. So anthropologists think that the first barley beer was most likely born in the Middle East. No doubt people were making fermented beverages, like Gilly just talked about, in China before this, but this is probably the first evidence that we have that people were making barley beverages and fermenting them. And that dates to about 5,000 years ago, which is the Sumerians of ancient Mesopotamia. Sumer is often called the cradle of civilization because it was supposed to be the birthplace of writing, the wheel, agriculture, the arch, the plow, irrigation, and beer, you know. So
all the good stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Sumer occupied the southern section of the rich plain between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers west of the Shat al-Arab waterway in what we know as modern-day Iraq. This is the region where hunter-gatherers first decided to settle down and cultivate crops. Dr. Solomon Katz of the University of Pennsylvania has theorized the primary motivation of the settlement was a need to grow grain to make beer and bread. This is what Dr. Katz said. My argument is that the initial discovery of a stable way to produce alcohol provided enormous motivation for continuing to go out and collect these seeds to try and get them to do better. Thank you, Dr. Katz.
Meow.
Meow. By about 5000 BC, the Sumerians were practicing year-round agriculture with irrigation and a specialized labor force. The Sumerians produced far more food than they needed, allowing them to reap profit for culture. This is actually the first time that we've seen people producing food for profit, which is kind of, it's important kind of in our whole weird capitalist bullshit now, but this is the first time that we're seeing people producing more than they need and trying to figure out what to do with it and selling it to other people. That's really important with this whole thing. Like, they literally had to produce a system of writing, the first system of writing that is considered to be a modern system of writing, cuneiform, was created so that these people could sell shit. And it was because of agriculture. Like, bread, beer, vegetables, like, they were making this just from this. And we know this because archaeologists have unearthed ceramic vessels from 3400 BC still sticky with beer residue. And we've seen there's literally a receipt from a couple hundred years later that's called, you know, the famous name for it is called the Receipt from Ululu. And the receipt from Ululu is, I mean, literally, guys, this is a receipt from a liquor store. Like, I'm not joking. Like, it is a 4,000-year-old receipt from a liquor store that said somebody bought beer from a guy named Ululu. Also, this guy's name was Ululu. But apparently he was the good guy. He was the guy with the beer. So at some point we find like that beer gets commercialized. Like it is one of the many things that gets commercialized, but the Sumerians were the people who literally commercialized agriculture. And a big part of that was, you have to think, in a civilization like this, 4,000, 5,000 years ago, they're not able to drink water. Like, the water that they are drinking from, you know, streams, ponds, things like that, you're not going to drink pond water. Pond water is gross as fuck. You can't do that. You can't do that. It's the same thing now. So drinking beer, even if it's a, you know, kind of a mildly alcoholic thing, that's actually much safer than drinking water. So, like, this got so crazy that Sumerians were literally getting paid in beer.
By the way, as the Sumerians got conquered by the Babylonians, beer consumption continued to flourish.
Under Babylonian rule, Mesopotamian beer production increased dramatically. It became more commercialized, and laws were instituted that literally were specifically to beer. As we go into this, we're going to talk about something that's called Hammurabi's Code. And again, shout out mom, this is tight. But Hammurabi's Code is like, it is so significant because this is the first... Probably not the first. Somebody's going to argue with me with that. Somebody's going to email in and say that's not right. But Hammurabi's Code is, it's the first constitution. It is the first set of laws that has been written down that we've found that is an entire civilization set of laws. It's really cool for that. Like, I mean, some of the things are probably actually not that cool. Like, you know, Hammurabi's Code is where, like, an eye for an eye is, actually from, but
is it, you know, literal in Hammurabi's
yes.
code?
Yeah. Literally, if you steal something, your arm gets cut off. Like, you know, that kind of shit. Like, it is hardcore. It is not nice. But that said, it is very cool from a anthropological standpoint because it is the first set of written laws that we have to study. So there were three specific laws that we saw from Hammurabi's Code that talk about beer. And Gilly is going to tell you the first one, which is called Law Number 108.
So the 108th law of this code states, if a tavern keeper, a lady, does not accept grain according to gross weight and payment of drink, but takes money and the price of the drink is less than that of the grain, she shall be convicted and thrown into the water. What?
So, apparently, all the way back, you know, 4,000 years ago, they were pretty concerned with getting shorted on their drinks. Yeah, you can't...
Aren't we all?
You can't make soft drinks. So, this law had to deal with, you know, people who are cheating their customers, who are watering down their drinks and stuff like that. You know, beer was, at that point, you have to realize it was a daily ration for a lot of people. So the amount received was, you know, dependent on people's social status, and people wanted what they deserved and what they were supposed to be given. Let's go to Law 109.
The 109th law in this code stated, if conspirators meet in the house of a tavern keeper, and these conspirators are not captured and delivered to the court, the tavern keeper shall be put to death.
So this one's really interesting because I feel like everything I ever learned about the Revolutionary War, like... And actually, like the French Revolution, like all that shit happened in taverns, yo.
Yeah.
Like all the people who like were the government at that point, they should have kept this in place because like that shit is what fucked them up. Like Hammurabi had it right. I actually 100% disagree with that. But you know, it's really interesting that 4,000 years ago, Hammurabi said, we are gonna say that, like, if we find out that treasonous people were trying to figure out how to be treasonous against the government, and it happens in your establishment, you are 100% responsible for that. Like, that's crazy. That's so authoritarian. And apparently, I mean, Hammurabi, like, there's other things about him, but yes, it's crazy, you know. Let's do 110.
So the 110th law of this code stated, if a sister of a god open a tavern or enter a tavern to drink, then shall this woman be burned to death.
Death. This one's weird, though, because beer was such a huge part of their culture, and they tried to, like, classify it, you know, as they said, obviously, in their culture, like, religious folk who were, you know, a member of their, you know, church, temple, whatever you want to call it, they were supposed to be higher up than the regular people. So they said, like, if you're a woman and you can, you're going to, you know, drink something, you can't do it in a tavern. And they didn't really have anything against priestesses drinking, but they just wouldn't want them to do it the same way a commoner would, which to me, obviously there's a weird classist thing to that, but, like, it's also, like, a weird, you know, I don't know, what do you think?
A lot of these laws seem kind of sexist. Like, I can't help but notice that all three of these laws have something against women, and it mentions that, like, I'm getting that most tavern keepers were women, and I'm wondering why all these beer laws were against women. I mean, a lot of civilizations, women were, I mean, a lot of ancient civilizations, a lot of women were kind of, like, you know, they were the lesser of the two, the then two genders, unless you go to Scandinavia, but, like, which is awesome. It's just a, I don't know, that's a weird observation I had.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. And I do think from our research, we found out that a lot of the people that were brewing this beverage at this time were women.
Yeah, so it's weird that the first civilization to brew beer proper had all these laws against
right
certain no, situation. Crazy. Yeah. Anyway.
Anyway. Yeah, Mesopotamia sucked. Yeah. Pretty much for anybody there, Mesopotamia probably sucked. But essentially, Mesopotamia got, there was the Sumerians first, and they were fine, and they kind of started all this thing. And then the Babylonians took them over. And
where did they come from, by the way?
Babylon.
I mean, I know that, but what is modern-day Babylon?
It's Mesopotamia.
Okay.
Like, the Sumerians, Babylonians, they were from the same period. I didn't do a lot of research in this part, so,
we're finding our gaps.
You're welcome.
It's cool. It's okay.
But essentially,
we researched beer.
Babylon, essentially, they took over the Sumerians, and they didn't really actually change a lot of the day-to-day. Like, they essentially took Sumerian culture and made it their own.
Right.
Hammurabi, actually, because I forgot to mention it earlier, Hammurabi was Babylonian. Like, we started talking about Hammurabi's code, that's Babylon. Like, you know, it was like, one day you're Sumerians, one day you're Babylonians. There was a lot of, you know, blood and death and stuff like that happened as well. But, you know, again, this is not a history podcast. It's a beer podcast. And we're trying to get through thousands of years of history real fast.
In a lot of countries, actually.
And a lot of countries. So essentially, the Babylonians were the people that really started trading with people. And that's the big thing about why Babylon was good, I guess, is they really started trade with people. And one of the big people that they started trade with was Egypt. And you know who really liked beer?
The Egyptians?
Yeah.
They also really like cats. So yeah. They kind of sound like my civilization.
So.
All hail Bastet.
Biggest thing about. So, biggest thing about Egypt is that they loved beer. Workers that were working on the pyramids, they were paid in beer. And it wasn't looked at as a type of beverage that was a low beverage. It wasn't looked at as a, you know, high class beverage. Everybody from the pharaohs to children drank beer as every part of their diet. A lot of these beers were flavored with like some weird shit. Like we know that the Egyptians were like, you know, pretty down with some weird shit, but like they were making beers with like mandrake, dates, and olive oil. Like I've never had a beer made with olive oil. I don't know if Gilly's ever had a beer made with olive oil, but like that doesn't sound real good.
Use what you got, I guess.
I guess, yeah. So you also have to remember at this point, these are still not like beers. None of them are made with hops. That it still doesn't come into play until like we get into like, you know, post-Christ Europe. Like these are probably really odd tasting. But Egypt is actually the one that we know the most about in terms of what they were making, and what they were brewing, because, you know, obviously the Mesopotamians, wrote a lot of stuff down, but the Egyptians also did this whole thing where they would put stuff in the tombs of their nobles and of their pharaohs. Like they would put models of like, this is what an Egyptian brewery looks like. This is all the notation of like how we make our beers. Like literally they put time capsules in the ground that, you know, all of these, you know, archaeologists found, and they're like, oh my God, this is how we make Egyptian beer. And that's why, like, even now, like we've seen a couple breweries make like an Egyptian beer because they've found, you know, they've used a recipe that somebody's found that's, you know, 4,000, 5,000 years old. Another cool thing about Egypt is they actually thought that brewing was given to them by the gods. They thought Osiris came down and gave them the instructions on how to brew.
Wow.
Which is pretty cool. So, you know, similar to Mesopotamia with Ninkasi, they actually saw beer as this huge, important part of life and civilization. Like, they were like, oh my God, this is our lifeblood.
And also similar to Mesopotamia, didn't they also consider brewing beer as a job for women?
Yeah, no, they totally did.
Okay. Yeah, because I found that in the early days, all the chief brewers were women working mostly out of their homes. Although at some point men took over the business, as we found miniature models of men working in breweries within the tombs of Egyptian nobles.
So, you know, obviously Egypt, Rome, and Greece are very tied together. Cleopatra and Mark Antony and all that. So, of course, beer traveled across the sea. And, well, it kind of fell flat when it got there. Because the Greeks and Romans, they didn't really like it. They liked wine. They were wine drinkers.
I mean, they had a whole god for it, right? Like, who is Dionysus? There's no god of beer.
Totally. Like, you got Dionysus and you got Bacchus. They're the same guy, but, you know, different names. Like,
oh, yeah. Greek, like, Rome.
That nobody really drank a lot of beer there.
Oh, shit, they missed out.
There are some records that, you know, soldiers drank beer and things like that, but it was really considered to be a low-class beer, and it was something that a lot of people thought, like, that's what barbarians drink, you know? Like, the Romans and the Greeks, we drink wine, but everybody else, they drink beer.
That is so white, if I ever heard.
I know, right? Like, super just like, oh, we're in our little...
Did they also shop at Whole Foods?
Yeah, like, we're in our little suburb, and we just drink wine. We just love rosé. I don't know, some of the biggest scholars in Greece and Rome said, like, no, we don't drink that shit. Like, you've got Xenophon, Sophocles, Tacitus, all of them are saying these things, including the emperor of Rome, Julian. He composed a poem where he said the scent of wine was the nectar of the gods. Well, the smell of beer was that of a goat.
Well, fuck that guy.
I'm just saying, like, sometimes, like, Larry smells like a goat, and I still love him, so whatever.
Also, he spelled his name wrong.
I know. He's good. Fucking Julian with an A. That's bullshit. So all this is happening across the pond. Like, it's crazy. But at the same time, with what we talked about at the beginning of this episode, this whole idea of, like, making booze out of the bread water, which is essentially what beer is, it's not just happening in Europe. It's not just happening in the Middle East. And so Gilly's going to kind of take us through another weird little part that's happening in South America at the same time.
I also, now that I've been given the torch, I also want to interject for a sec and say that my chocolate cherry Yeti Imperial Stout is pretty tasty. It's like drinking a donut, but like in the best ways.
Wait, can I try it?
Yeah, you can.
It's got the most impressive can, and I've been staring at it in the fridge for like a week, and I've been really jealous.
So have I. Slurp that up. Right?
Oh my god, that's good.
Like some, you better give it back. Like some pastry stouts. I had a pastry stout earlier this week that, like, I was actually surprised. I kind of couldn't really stomach it. I drank it anyway, so I was a little nervous, but this is showing up.
It's yummy.
Anyway, sorry, where were we? South America?
Well, mine's, I mean, do we do, should we, I wanted to talk about mine too.
Oh, you want to talk about your beer? You can talk about your beer.
I can talk about my beer. Mine's not that interesting, but it's just a pretty standard West Coast IPA.
You're talking about the Sierra Nevada, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like I was saying, it's like, I think Sierra Nevada does awesome.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I got it because it looked exciting and we happened to be out. And yeah.
Yeah, how are we out of beer?
I don't know.
No idea.
I don't know.
Anyway.
South America.
Back to the history lesson. South America, actually, their beer tradition still goes on today. So this relates to my earlier talk about the Stanford study. In that same study that recreated the Chinese beer, they tried another recipe using a vegetable root called a manioc, which is indigenous to South American tribes. So the brew made with manioc is called a chicha. I can't make this up. It's made by chewing the manioc and then spitting it out.
Which is actually, I mean, that's a pretty, that was a thing in South America, Latin America in the ancient times, because you have things like pulque, which was the predecessor to some people say that it's the predecessor to tequila, where people would chew agave and they'd spit it. I guess
you gotta mash it up somehow, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, yeah. Why not use your immediate resource?
Yeah,
your
teeth. I mean, the French use their feet for wine. Why not?
Yeah, freaking weirdos. Just kidding.
Weirdos. Fucking weirdos. All of them.
Oh, so it was made by chewing it, then spitting it out, and then it got boiled and fermented. So there's a show called Brewmasters, and it specifically covers chicha. So if you're still interested, like, really check it out. There's still people that make chicha in Peru today, actually.
And actually, like, if you've never seen an episode of Brewmasters, it's really fun. I think it was a little bit before its time, but
yeah, like craft beer now and history and overall, like, nerdom and food culture has taken off so much since they made that show.
But essentially it's this guy who owns Dogfish Head. He's a cool dude, and it's just him, like, trying to make new beer, and it's really fun, and I'm sure it got canceled for some reason or another, but it's pretty cool. You can find it on Amazon though.
Cool. Oh, so back to this Stanford study where they made this chicha alongside the Lao Li. The students were apparently too skeptical to try the chicha. Well, I think it's because people were spitting the or chewing the ingredients and then spitting it out. I'm not 100% sure why.
I wouldn't trust college students spit.
I mean, maybe that's right. But also, like, they would drink the stuff that had the white mold on top.
I'd drink that.
I mean, we
I would drink something like that over somebody who had college students spit.
Let's move on to the ingredients of chicha. Chicha can also be made with corn, which is the most common way of making chicha. I'm just having a fun time saying chicha. Not gonna
chicha,
lie.
Chicha.
Chicha. Chicha, I choose you. I don't know. other substitutions include quinoa, peanut, palm fruit, potato, and other edible South America plants. I guess the only qualifications is that you kind of chew it and you spit it out. The exact origin of the word chicha is debated. Some think that the Spanish conquistadors used to describe any kind of fermented South American drink as chicha. But according to the Real Academia Española and other authors, the word chicha comes from the Cuno word chichab or chiab, which means maize. Some think it comes from the Nahuatl word chichiatl, which means fermented water. The verb chicha meaning to sour a drink, ATL meaning water. So this is actually kind of like widespread throughout South America. It's mostly in the Amazonia and Andes regions. Mills in which it was made have been found in Machu Picchu, which I thought was pretty cool because Machu Picchu is this really notable landmark. And then it's also like, hi, we made a cousin of beer here.
But like they used it for ritual and ceremonial.
Yeah, similar to ancient China, actually, the Incans used chicha for ritual and ceremonial purposes. It was a holy beverage. Incan women were taught the techniques of brewing chicha in Akilawasi, which were the feminine schools.
So women, again.
Yeah, again. I mean, I don't know why craft brewing is such a male-dominated thing now.
Well, because women can't grow these big, nasty beards.
Okay. I mean, I don't know. Okay, challenge accepted. So the Incans had specific places you could consume chicha. These were taverns called chichereras. Chicherias. Thank you. So chicha was generally drunk on location at the chicherera or sold as a half liter in the earthenware pot it was brewed in.
And actually, you know, from what we watched with the Brewmasters episode on chicha and then a little bit of Googling after that, chicherias are still a thing in certain parts of Peru and...
It's, like, passed down, isn't it? Isn't it kind of like a tradition?
It is. Yeah, like, it's a thing. Like, you can go and you can still drink chicha.
That's so rad.
And it's this beverage that's thousands of years old.
And, like, delightfully hazy. Like, I remember, like, looking at a cup of it on Brewmasters and it looked really, like, cloudy, yeah. But, like, in a really inviting way. It looked like a really hazy IPA.
Right, and it's this, like, crazy beverage that just had, you know... thousands of years of awesome heritage, you know?
Yeah. So speaking of chicha and where it is today, on the northern coast of Peru, it is still served in a poto, which is a dried gourd. In the Andes, it is served in a wooden, glass, or metal cup with intricate carvings, and that is called a caro. Incan leaders used identical pairs of caros to extend invitations to drink. These invitations represented a indebtedness upon the invitee. In this way, the drinking of chicha via caros cemented relationships of power and alliances between people and groups. You know,
That's some fucking Game of Thrones shit.
That is some Game of Thrones shit. And I mean, it just kind of like really cements our like saying before of beer really has been bringing people together.
Yeah. I drink beer and I know things.
Yeah, you do. So there's lots of actually regional variations of chicha, which we won't go over here just because there's so many. But I wanted to list all the countries and regions in South America that do brew chicha.
And this is countries that still brew.
And they still brew chicha. And I mean, there's so many variations because there's also a lot of tribes, or have been a lot of tribes within all these countries. So for me to go over all the variations that alone that I could find, it would take another 45 minutes or whatever. So here are the countries that brew chicha. The area of Amazonia, which includes the interiors of Ecuador, Peru, and Brazil. Bolivia brews chicha. Chile, Colombia, El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, Panama, Venezuela. Yeah, that's like like 95% of the countries in South America. So I thought it was kind of amazing that this one recipe, it can have its variants, but it is one recipe is found throughout a whole continent.
Yeah.
So the production of chicha holds a lot of social status all over South America. Chicha is consumed during feasts, which is a powerful way for people to connect over community, race, gender, and nationality.
And I think beer is still consumed today over feasts.
Yeah, feasts of more beer.
Feasts of more beer, barbecues. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's a way for people to connect and things like that. And it's really interesting. Like,
yeah.
All of these ancient cultures essentially were holding barbecues and getting a six pack, you know, like, it's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a lot of fun researching this one because there's just so much history and like the evolution of beer and how it's brought people together or divided people or developed an economy in many cases. Yeah. That was really fun to look up.
Yeah. No, I mean, this is just all of the kind of ancient history. At some point, we're going to do a more like Middle Ages, Renaissance history of beer. But
yeah, because even Middle Ages could be a whole other episode, actually.
It's so cool how beer, you know, originally had, you know, it had so much significance in people's lives.
Yeah.
You know, to the point that it's, you know, people are paying people in beer.
Yeah.
It's really cool. And yeah. So, you know, thanks for getting to the end of our second episode.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I hope this one was really as interesting to you all as it was to us to research it. How's your beverage?
My beverage is pretty good.
Yeah. What were you drinking again?
I was drinking the Sierra Nevada Hoppy Anniversary Ale, 40 years old, limited edition.
Yeah?
It was pretty good.
Do you have any, like, specific thoughts on the tasting?
Hold on.
You gotta drink more.
It's hoppy and it's nice. It kind of tastes like a lot of other Sierra Nevada product. You know, it's good. It's got a good hop value to it, and that's all I have.
Yeah, I actually
like I don't care. I really don't care a lot about Sierra Nevada because
for what it's worth, like before this episode, I had one of the same ones, and I don't know, I just like the earthiness that it had. I mean, Sierra Nevada always has this kind of like earthy, hoppy taste to it, and I do enjoy that.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Like, it's just a good, nice, hoppy
beer.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've been drinking the Chocolate Cherry Yeti Imperial Stout from Great Divide. You know, it's very nice. Like I said earlier, I had a pastry stout the other week that I wasn't a big fan of. So I was a little, intimidated by trying this, but I really liked it. It has like a nice dark fruity flavor, but without being too fruity. And I said earlier, it's like drinking a donut. But I mean that in like all the good ways. I thought it was really yummy.
Yeah. So we did want to kind of go over a little bit of beer in the news, which is, again, hard because we're in the middle of...
Yeah, you know, a whole lot going on right now.
This whole coronavirus thing. But I did see a few things. It looks like, you know, there's a couple of the large distributors of beer that are trying, or I'm not really sure if they are, and if you are a big beer distributor, please let us know. Or a, you know, a small bar or a brewery that's having issues with getting, you know, getting your product bought back, or you know, getting your product distributed at the moment. Because essentially everything that I'm looking at is pretty rough.
What did you find?
So obviously we're still in the middle of this social distancing craziness.
We're 6 feet away from each other right now.
We are. We are very much 6 feet away from each other, even though we live together and sleep together. Yeah. It's, it's crazy. Like, we had to order a 12 foot wide bed just to do it. No, but seriously, like, a lot of our friends who are, you know, small, you know, inventory brewers are having a really hard time. And Gilly and I have been trying to support them and trying to support, like, you know, our local beer shops and stuff like that, like Hop Merchants, McLeod, Trustworthy. We're going there, and we're picking up the six packs, picking up the four packs, picking up the, you know, the pizzas.
I mean, last episode when we said we were gonna get pizza at McLeod,
yeah, literally
we weren't kidding.
We literally wrapped the episode and picked up pizza,
and it was so good.
And we encourage you to do the same thing. Like, it's pretty fast to figure out who's doing what and who's doing what where. And, you know, it sucks. And I was actually, I had all this stuff that I was going to talk about with, you know, keg buybacks and stuff like that. And the more I read about it, like, a lot of these, you know, a lot of these places, even especially near me, are kind of getting a little bit hosed by it. But, essentially, even these big beer distributors are trying to buy back kegs of unopened, undrank beer that bars are having problems selling. Like, there's not a lot in the news besides that. Like, it kind of sucks. But
yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty cool that a lot of like local breweries and bottle shops have, you know, still stayed open. And I think it's cool that we're in such a time now that people want that local homemade beer.
I agree.
Where that can thrive.
Yeah.
But it is kind of a hard time for small businesses.
And absolutely.
I don't have a proposition because everyone's doing the right thing.
Yeah.
We all need to stay healthy and alive, and this thing does kill people. But, you know, I just hope everyone can come out of it kind of stronger.
Totally.
Yeah. I mean, I will say, if it helps kind of end this on a higher note, I had some things from social media I'd gathered that was similar to the stuff I had from last episode about deliveries and breweries that have that are open for pickups.
Totally. Yeah. I think you should definitely check out your local breweries and things like that. Like,
yeah,
places that you like to go, most of them are open and most of them are offering, you know, pickups. Mm-hmm. And
if you're not sure, honestly, like, the best places to sort of curate all of your favorite, like, yummy beers and whatnot are to follow them on Instagram. And they are posting their hours and when they're open and whether they deliver and what their delivery radius is. Totally. So you can have in one whole feed on your Instagram, you can have, oh, here's all of my favorite beer places and how I can still drink and support them.
Yeah, I mean, even tonight, like, on our Instagram, we saw Chai Pai was delivering at Glendale Tap, and we thought, like, oh yeah, that could be a fun place to, you know, go pick up some beers and stuff like that. So,
and pizza, like, what an ultimate combo. Oh my God, pizza.
So,
and I will say, sort of riffing off of how I ended the episode last time, I mentioned Modern Times doing deliveries, but you had to order the same, like, 6-4 packs of beer. That's no longer the case. They are doing mixed cases now, from what I gathered. And so is Highland Park Brewery, I think, is also doing mixed cases and deliveries. Yes. And Golden Road, which is one of our bigger breweries out here, but they are also
one
doing
of the corporate breweries.
They're a little more corporate, but they're still, like, you know, they got started in LA. They got started as, like, a home brewery. Their tap room is open, so you can go pick up beer, and they also have food. And I myself have had my eye on their Impossible Burger for a couple of days. So there's that.
Yeah, and speaking of Instagram, you can follow us on Instagram at Pint Size Podcast. You can follow us on Facebook at Pint Size Podcast. Or you can also listen to our Apple Podcast or our Spotify, also at Pint Sized Podcast.
Or if you have anything to add from this episode or any questions, or you just want to say hello, you can email us at
pintsizedpodcast@gmail.com.
Cool. Any last words, Julian?
I think that's it.
I think we said a lot of words.
I think all we have to do now is say, you know, hang out, be cool, stay frosty.
Stay healthy.
Yeah. Until next Sunday.
Cheers. And,
you know, wash your hands.
Wash your hands.
Wash Cheers. Your hands.